From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, state lawmakers give the VIP treatment to bills that boost corporate and special interest political donations.
While on the surface there is disclosure, there's not ultimately disclosure of where the true source of the money was.
China becomes the latest and biggest to talk of banning internal combustion engines.
Cities don't want these dirty, polluting vehicles anymore within their urban limits.
Wayne County leading the way in prosecuting crimes committed against people who are LGBTQ.
The message is, the state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're gay. The state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're trans. But Wayne County does.
And we'll learn about the great Michigan moose drop. It was no small task. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the Wayne County prosecutor joins forces with Fair Michigan to investigate and prosecute crimes committed against people who are LGBTQ.
I think people are at least beginning to realize that everybody deserves justice.
At least I can say, well, maybe the state of Michigan doesn't care about you, but Wayne County does.
But first, don't say state lawmakers can't move quickly when they want to. Republicans in Lansing hit the gas pedal to pass legislation that could greatly increase corporate and special interest spending on political campaigns. The legislation sailed through the Senate last week and cleared the House Tuesday, headed straight for the governor's desk. Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network is here with us now. Supporters, Craig, say that these bills just codify the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Citizens United. Critics say it's Citizens United on steroids. What's your take?
Yeah, I have been one of the critics. I will clearly say that. I mean, Citizens United was a court decision that said governments can't put limits on independent spending by corporations and labor unions. So the question that the legislature is answering in this bill is, what is independent? And I've argued, and others have argued, that the definition of independent in this bill is a very minor one, and it allows candidates to work very closely with these supposedly independent groups. And you might say, well, why is that important? Well, candidates in Michigan can't take money from corporations, and they're in limits on what donors can give. But if they can work closely with the super PAC, the thing about super PACs is they can take unlimited contributions, and they can take money from murky corporations and other groups that maybe can conceal the identity of the true donor.
What actually will change in Michigan with passage of these bills?
Okay, so right now in Michigan, our laws do not reflect Citizens United. They do not include language that says this is the process for a super PAC, or what these bills say, an independent expenditure committee. So what's going to happen under these bills is a true legal framework in law is going to be put in place for super PACs and how they're supposed to operate. Up until this point, over the last 7 years, it's basically been up to the Secretary of State and people who work for her to basically interpret it how they believe it should be interpreted. And now the legislature is chiming in and saying, this is what the policy is going to be for our state going forward, and it's going to be in law.
Regarding the inability to trace just where campaign money comes from, that term we all hear, dark money, House Representative Aaron Miller, Republican and chair of the House Elections and Ethics Committee, said the bills will provide a construct for super PACs to operate and require reporting. In his words, it's quite the opposite of dark money. Do these bills make it easier for us, the public, to know who has donated money and how much to support a certain candidate? Is it the opposite of dark money, as he says?
It's one of those questions where it might be one answer on the surface, and then you watch it play out, it's a completely different answer. So what you have happen with super PACs is that they do have to list who their donors are. So that's point A. They list who their donors are. But point B, which is just as important, maybe more important, as we've seen this play out across the country, is they can take money from corporate entities. So what's a corporate entity? Well, we've seen this happen at the federal level. Someone could set up an LLC one day, a new business entity, and then all of a sudden that LLC the next day could start giving money to a super PAC. And then you have to go look, well, who's behind this LLC? If you've ever done any research into trying to figure out who's behind a certain company or a nonprofit, it's not always that easy. You know, we have disclosure for ballot proposals in Michigan. The same argument that Rep. Miller has made, like, we know who the donors to ballot proposals are. Not really, because what you have with ballot proposals that also can take corporate money is you have these nonprofits that are taking money from somewhere and then giving the money to the ballot proposal. So really, when you look at the disclosure, it just says it came from the nonprofit. But the real question is, where did that nonprofit get the money from? So while on the surface there is disclosure, there's not ultimately disclosure of where the true source of the money was.
Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhof says campaign donations, meaning money, are a way to exercise free speech. What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think that's an argument that is somewhat unrelated to this bill. I mean, the bill is not about someone's ability to spend money to express their thoughts. That's already been granted under Citizens United. The bill is about how closely candidates can work with these independent groups. I mean, if you read Citizens United, I hate to encourage your listeners to put themselves through reading those 57 pages, but there is an idea of what is independent described there. There is an argument made that this is not going to lead to the appearance of corruption because this is independent of candidates. But most people with common sense would look at a candidate going out and asking a donor to, you know, write a six-figure check to a super PAC that, man, that could be an ethical problem going forward if it's hard to trace and if they can do this regularly.
How could this affect politics in Michigan, Craig?
It's hard to tell. I mean, we have super PACs operating in the state already. I think with this in law, people who work in this field are going to feel a lot more secure about what they can and can't do. It's going to make sure that this type of activity is going to be going on going forward. I mean, I think it's going to lead to more money in politics. Something that hasn't been talked a lot about is it's going to give even more power to the lawmakers who are in the best position to raise money. So if you're the Senate Majority Leader or the House Speaker, and everyone wants to give you money because you're basically running the agenda of the chamber, you're going to have more power because now you can work closely with a super PAC and feel that you're safe doing that because of this law.
Craig Mauger, Michigan Campaign Finance Network. As always, thanks so much, Craig.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When your biggest customer talks, smart companies listen. The biggest customer for car makers is China. So when China recently announced it's preparing to ban vehicles powered by fossil fuels, auto execs around the world sat up and took quick notice. Here now from London is BBC business reporter Russell Padmore. Russell, why is this being described as a tipping point for the global auto industry?
Cynthia, we're suddenly seeing this rush towards electric cars. It's been going on for a while, actually, but it seems to have come to a head around this motor show, the auto show, which is on in Frankfurt at the moment. It's still got another few days to run. We've seen the giants of the industry demonstrating their vehicles there, and all the talk of the industry leaders at this motor show, this auto show in Frankfurt, has been about electric cars. The future is seen as electric. It's interesting you mentioned China's talking about banning electric cars. We have other cities around the world, I should say, banning diesel or petrol or gasoline vehicles, not electric cars. Electric is the future, many cities seem to think. And of course, we've seen this scandal involving Volkswagen pretty recently. VW's run into trouble cheating on those diesel emissions tests. Well, Paris, for example, says it's going to ban diesel engines in the future in vehicles. Chengdu in China, Madrid, Oslo, Mexico City moving in that direction as well. So you can see there's a move around the world. And this is something, interestingly, the industry is moving towards recognizing. Cities don't want these dirty, polluting vehicles anymore within their urban limits, and therefore they think the future is going to be electric. Kind of interesting that many cars in Europe, many car makers in Europe and Asia are leading the way. The American manufacturers seem, anyway, Cynthia, to be behind the curve.
Well, it's kind of interesting when you think about the Detroit 3. They have pumped billions into developing electronic technology, certainly prodded by the Obama era fuel economy standards that land on them in 2025. But consumers in America are sort of, you know, they're shrugging and then buying a pickup or an SUV.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there, Cynthia. Those large gas-guzzling vehicles still seem to be so popular in the United States. Now, look at Ford. Plug-in hybrid sales, 23,900 for 2016. Actually, GM in August sold 2,052 vehicles of its Bolt, the Chevrolet Bolt. This is seen as the big rival, perhaps, to the Tesla car. Now, Tesla, that luxury sports car maker, has been claiming it'll be selling its vehicles to 1 million people every year by 2020. That, I think, is a bit ambitious, even though Tesla seems to be doing quite well. Electric seems to be the future. Now, we've been hearing from so many of the car manufacturers. Pretty recently, actually, we heard from Jaguar, or Jaguar Land Rover. We had the chief executive of that company pointing out how that company, with its SUVs, the Land Rover, and those luxury cars, the Jag, they want also to be selling electric cars, offering electric versions by 2020.
From 2020 onwards, all of our vehicles will be electrified. And we're offering a portfolio of products, mild hybrid, battery electric vehicles, or PHEVs, so the customer can choose. But I also would like to emphasize that is not the end of the internal combustion engine.
That's Dr. Ralph Speth. He's the chief executive, also chairman of Jaguar Land Rover, pointing out, ultimately, Cynthia, the traditional gasoline engine, the diesel engine, it's not the end of the line for it. They'll still be making those. But 2020 is the date when they also want to go electric.
But the chief executive of Toyota Europe, Russell, has an interesting option to talk about.
It is kind of interesting. We keep talking about electricity. A lot of people are saying, well, that's okay. Electric might be the future. Okay, the US is behind the curve. The big companies like Toyota seem to be ahead of the game. We know that they've been making their Prius or Prius hybrid vehicle for a long time. But kind of intriguing when we look at the infrastructure. Where's all the charging points going to be? If you live in an apartment, you're not going to be like someone who lives in a house. You can have a charging point nearby. It is a bit awkward. And this is something that's challenged the industry generally. But Toyota is kind of looking at a future where maybe electric is not the way to go. And they, of course, have great experience. Well, the head of Toyota Motor in Europe, the chief executive of its European operations, is Johan van Zyl. He kind of thinks we should focus on hydrogen.
Hydrogen society needs to be created. And that will take, of course, longer than creating an electric infrastructure. But hydrogen in the long term is really, really a very good solution in terms of alternative form of energy. Of course, the fact is you can utilize hydrogen to store energy, which is an energy carrier. If you want to convert renewable energy and store it, you need to put it in big, massive batteries. So I don't know whether it's really practical to do it that way.
Well, that's Toyota's view. Hydrogen's the future. Ford, of course, is planning to invest $4.5 billion in electric vehicles by 2020. General Motors still playing catch-up. OK, the Chevrolet Bolt might be GM's big offer, but ultimately people still buying those big SUVs, Cynthia.
They are indeed a watershed moment for the global auto industry. Russell Padmore, business reporter for the BBC. Many, many thanks, Russell.
Cynthia, great to be with you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been a 36-acre headache for years for the city of Ypsilanti, but now it's shaping up to become something that could transform the city. It is a vacant city-owned lot near downtown. Last night, the Ypsilanti City Council agreed to move forward with negotiations on a major housing and retail development for that vacant lot, a mixed-use development called International Village that would be partially funded by Chinese investors, relying on the federal EB-5 visa program. Here are some of the voices that spoke at that city council meeting, which lasted over 6 hours.
I take the statement by the developers that global capital will eventually come for us as being a threat. Ipsy becoming like all of those other gentrified cities is not progress.
I mean, I still think it could bring a lot of money here, as long as the people who's been here don't get pushed out. Yeah. That's it.
We should not have programs that benefit the rich, but we do, and it might benefit Ypsilanti.
I would say that anybody in this council who does not vote for a viable project for Water Street is going to have hundreds of people actively fighting against them in the next election.
Those were the voices of Ypsilanti residents Finn Bell and Karan Gaines, and Ypsilanti City Council members Beth Bashert and Daniel Vaught. The EB-5 program lets foreigners invest in U.S. developments that create jobs in exchange for U.S. visas once the jobs are created. The proposed cost of International Village would be upwards of $300 million. The developers now have till year's end to reach a development agreement with the city of Ypsilanti. With us now to talk about the project and the EB-5 program is Gary McRae, manager of the Michigan International Investments EB-5 Regional Center. Gary, can you explain to us very basically just how EB-5 works from the perspective of foreign investors?
Well, the program attempts to bring in capital from foreign investors and use the capital here in the United States to create jobs. And it's been around since the 1990s. It's been pretty successful. It's brought in about $20 billion of development capital. So there is one major project over in St. Joe, Michigan, which is was run through my center, and that was a hotel marina called Harbor Shores. And that was about a $37 million project, and about $18 million were EB-5 funds brought in by 36 Chinese investors. And it provided capital and the appropriate number of jobs. The jobs have to be 10 jobs for every $500,000 investment if you happen to be in what's called a TEA, which is a high unemployment area. And so it basically provides capital and jobs, and it can be a great thing for a community.
In doing that development, Harbor Shores in St. Joe, what were your main takeaways? What did you learn?
The program takes a long time. You have to go out and find investors. They have to be their money has to be put into escrow and collected, and then it's part of the financing. So this financing is at retail instead of going to a bank. So it's a little more complicated. It's like the old limited partnerships that we used to have in the 1990s and years after that, where you collected equity from a series of investors. So it's a little more complex than just going to a bank or to a lending institution. But it provides needed capital, and that is a very successful project. All the investors have gotten their 526s, which is their first round of approval, and they're now about to apply for permanent green cards. And so it can be successful, and it can produce the required jobs.
Gary, you've looked over some of the details of the International Village. This is this proposed $300 million or maybe more project that would build housing and retail space in Ypsilanti, with 40% of the funding coming from Chinese EB-5 investors. A lot of the details, though, of the project would have to be negotiated between Ypsilanti and the development team. So as someone who develops EB-5 projects, what questions would you have about International Village?
Well, the first question is, have they done this before with the EB-5 program? If they've had experience, or they have people with them that have had experience in doing other EB-5 projects around the country, that would be helpful, because you've become more confident that they would be able to be successful.
That's a very basic question, isn't it?
Yes, because there haven't been any projects of that magnitude in Michigan. You know, that project, if you took 40% of $350 million, you'd have to have $140 million in EB-5 funds. So you'd have to produce 2,800 jobs. So one of the first issues is, do you have a consultant that has indicated that this type of project will produce the requisite jobs?
Well, actually, interesting, at the city council meeting last night, developers were talking about creating some 2,600 jobs, and these would have to come through for the Chinese investors to get these visas, correct?
That's correct.
Now, what kind of jobs count and what jobs don't count?
Well, if the construction takes more than 2 years, you can count some of the construction jobs that are involved. What you do is you use formulas that will predict jobs based upon the industry involved.
Based on what your impressions and what you've seen so far, do you think International Village will create enough jobs?
Well, you really would have to see the economic report from some consultant like Baker Tilly to know that. And I'm sure they'll have to get that type of consulting report at some point. They may not have gotten anything now. They may have just some preliminary projections. So I'm confident this type of project can be successful. I just haven't seen any details.
Critics of the EB-5 program say it's an immigration program that favors the rich. But you have said you see this as a brain drain in the United States' favor. What do you mean by that?
Well, what happens is that, admittedly, this is a program for people that can come up with a $500,000 investment. at a minimum, if not more. And but many of those people are highly educated. They're often the elite of their country. They're typically businessmen and women that are trying to diversify. So you're pulling this talent into the U.S., having them invest in the U.S., creating a, solving a capital problem, and then they create jobs. And so it's a win-win for everyone, and they suddenly have now a stake in the success of their investment in the United States. And if you're trying to bridge understanding between the U.S. and China, you really have their attention when you have their large investments here in the U.S.
Gary, the EB-5 program itself was set to expire at the end of the month. It was recently extended to December 8th. So how uncertain is the future of this program, and could that affect this International Village proposal?
Well, this EB-5 program has been renewed for many, many years. It's sort of on a five-year basis and then yearly renewals. Recently, because of the dysfunction between the Democrats and the Republicans, the renewals are often tied to the funding of the government. So when the government is only funded 3 months, the EB-5 program gets extended for 3 months. When the government is funded for another 6 months, we get another 6-month extension. So everyone's hoping for longer extensions to make it more clear that these projects can go forward.
Gary McRae, manager of the Michigan International Investments EB-5 Regional Center. Gary, thanks for your time.
Okay, you're welcome. Nice talking to you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused to do so.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
The moose are coming, the moose are coming. That might not have been actually chanted, but it was the feeling across much of the Upper Peninsula as Michigan completed reestablishing moose population in the UP. It is Wednesday, which means it's time to talk about Michigan's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. Here with us now is Rachel Clark, back from the Michigan History Center. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
And we have retired DNR wildlife veterinarian Steve Schmidt. Welcome, Steve.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So happy to talk about moose. Rachel, before the arrival of Europeans, where did moose live in Michigan?
Moose were pretty much all over Michigan prior to the arrival of Europeans. There was a small section of southwestern Michigan that didn't have the same population numbers, but moose are pretty much all over Michigan at that time. As people were moving into Michigan and settling, they're overhunting the moose and also they're destroying essentially the moose's habitat. So as they're clearing out the woods to create farms and those landscapes, they're destroying the moose habitat. So the moose are either dying or moving. 1935 is when there are the first efforts to repopulate the Upper Peninsula with moose.
And Steve, how did that go?
Not so well.
Why?
Well, one of the most important was deer had a biological weapon, basically a parasite called brain worm that doesn't cause a problem in the deer, but when it gets into the moose, it will kill them. As they cleared the forest up north, the deer population was able to increase, and that adversely affected the moose population.
So I want to drill down now on this second moose translocation, because as you say, the first one did not go so well. So now take us up to the second moose relocation. When was that?
Basically, we moved moose in 1985 and 1987. The idea there was that the habitat was changing, becoming more advantageous to moose. Moose were already there when the Europeans came in, so we knew, you know, we could bring them back if we reintroduced some, and that was the idea behind it.
Moving moose from Ontario, whereabouts, where did you get them from?
Algonquin Park.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a big provincial park. that park had an overabundance of moose, and so they were happy to have us capture some and move them to Michigan. And we actually did a little bit of a trade. We gave them some wild turkeys.
Okay. You can have some of our wild turkeys. We'll take some of the surplus moose.
Exactly.
I want to talk about the logistics of this. First of all, how big, how heavy is a full-grown moose?
An average size for a cow would be 900 to 1,000 pounds, and the bull's up to 1,200 pounds.
Okay, so this is not just, hey, try to board the little trailer and we'll truck it across.
No.
We're talking about a big, heavy animal. So you were a key part of this second moose relocation. What did it take to get the moose from Ontario to the Upper Peninsula?
Well, it took a lot of effort. Started out over in Algonquin Park with a helicopter, basically a capture gun, shooting out of the helicopter, tranquilizing the moose, putting them in a sling, lifting them up, taking back to a processing area where we had crates, where the animals could be put in the crates. And then at the end of the day, truck drivers would head out and drive all night long to the release site in the UP.
Now, there was some helicopter action here.
Oh, yes. A Hughes 500 chase helicopter. And we would spot a moose, usually in some hardwoods, move them out into a frozen lake where I could get in close with the helicopter.
Okay.
In fact, the shooting was the easy part. It was a helicopter pilot. He had the hard work of getting me in close. Then it was kind of point-blank range. You dart the animal, and then he also had to keep that animal out on the frozen lake, out on the ice, which though it had some snow cover, maybe a foot of snow, for 7 to 10 minutes for the drugs to take effect and the animal to go down. And that was harder than it sounds. Those animals wanted to get back into the woods, and so he had to drop down below tree line, very close to the moose, keeping it out on the lake until it became immobilized.
And then they were put on slings and transported to where they, as you say, could be crated and trucked to Michigan. Actually, anybody could go to YouTube and watch the video. It is quite stunning to see this moose being in its sling, being carried through the air. How taxing was all of this for the animal, Steve?
There's no doubt there's a lot of stress involved. First, we were hazing them out of the woods. Then we were using a potent narcotic. Then you're flying them through the air for possibly 15 minutes, putting them in a crate, giving the reversal drug so they'd stand up, and then driving them all night long. So, yes, a lot of stress. So we had to monitor these animals all the time.
And how many in total were you able to move during these the relocation, this second relocation?
29 in 1985 and 30 in 1987.
Rachel Clark, what was the local reaction in the UP to getting moose back in there again?
Oh, people were really excited. Every time a crew came back into the Marquette area with the moose, there were crowds of people there to watch them released and go off into the woods. So people were very excited, not only to see moose. I've lived in Michigan my whole life. I've camped in the UP. I have yet to lay eyes on a moose. Hmm. I don't know that I've known anyone other than Dr. Schmidt who's actually seen a moose. So.
Something like 10,000 people saw those animals released over the week time that, you know, there would be a release every day. The governor was up there one day, and they would bring busloads of school kids.
Indeed. Dr. Schmidt, how is the moose population doing today? I know you have retired as DNR wildlife veterinarian, but that wasn't that long ago. How are they doing?
Well, there's about 350 moose. Now, that's a lot less than what we had hoped to have, but there's something going on in the moose population in the southern part of the range.
And when we're saying that southern part of the range, what are we talking about?
The border of Canada and the U.S. In some places, having a lot more issues than we are.
Hmm.
Some of them, areas have had dramatic declines. Minnesota is one, Maine another. And they're not sure what is going on. It looks like it's a number of things. The brain worm that I mentioned earlier, liver fluke is another one. Winter ticks, the temperatures, these animals are cool, loving animals, so hot summers are not good for them. That also helps increase the parasites like the winter ticks. Nobody knows for sure, but it looks like it's a combination of factors that is adversely affecting moose populations in the southern part of the range. Now, there's examples, Isle Royal.
Hmm.
As you all know, we only have two wolves out there, and the moose population is exploding.
What's your long-range forecast, do you think, Steve, for moose in the UP?
Well, I've got my fingers crossed. you know, it was one of the most interesting and challenging and then rewarding activities that I got to do as the veterinarian for the Michigan DNR. So I've got my fingers crossed that we're, you know, kind of stabilized and possibly, you know, we'll start to increase again like we did when we first released the animals.
And Rachel Clark, you can keep hoping, right, as you camp, that you will one day clap eyes on a moose.
I am always hopeful.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark and retired DNR wildlife veterinarian Dr. Steve Schmidt. We want to thank you for sharing with us the story of Michigan's moose reestablished population dropped right in there to the Upper Peninsula. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's called the Fair Michigan Justice Project. It's a collaboration between the LGBTQ advocacy group Fair Michigan and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. It all began just over a year ago in July 2016. This marks an important new approach to pursuing hate crimes that are committed against people who are LGBTQ. It's especially noteworthy today as this week the Michigan Civil Rights Commission declined a request to add protections for the LGBTQ community to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, a law that is designed to prohibit discrimination in our state. To learn what the Fair Michigan Justice Project is and what it's accomplished in the past year, we welcome Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy and from Fair Michigan, Attorney and President Dana Nessel, and the Special Prosecutor for the Fair Michigan Justice Project, Jamie Powell Horowitz. So, Dana, what drove you to come up with this idea? What was not working?
What I had seen, unfortunately, over the course of many years was what seemed to be a large number of hate crimes that were being committed against the LGBTQ community. And personally, I was getting a lot of complaints from people who were saying that they didn't feel like they were adequately protected by the criminal justice system and that they were very afraid to report these crimes. And they felt that the crimes were going, not just that they were not reporting them, but that they were not being properly investigated when they did report them. They were not being solved. They were not being prosecuted. And it seemed as though this was an area where there was a real need for some reform.
And Kim, what is it that you weren't getting in order to pursue these crimes?
I was getting not really pushback, but I was reading about all these cases. And one day I asked the chief, had they been solved? What's happening with these cases? I knew, because I live close to Palmer Park, I knew that there had been a number of cases of missing African-American women of color, trans women, or killed, and many issues. And I checked, and I never saw any warrants come into my office. And I checked with my warrants, like we didn't have any. And I knew I had personally heard of probably four or five at least, and maybe not that high, but I just remember hearing that.
And they stuck in your mind and
they
heart.
Stuck in my mind. They stuck in my mind, absolutely. And, you know, not only because they were LGBTQ, but because they were women of color. So I called the person that I knew would be able to help. She came up with the idea. I told her what the problem was. Mm-hmm. She's the one that came up with the solution. But the end game is that we decided to partner. And it's been more successful than I think any of us imagined.
So this collaboration, it really is pretty unique in the country, isn't it?
As far as I know,
we're the only ones.
I think Wayne County's the only county prosecutor's office that has a task force that operates the way that ours does.
So who's on the task force? So give us an idea of what it's about.
So what we decided to do is, through this collaboration, to have a task force that focused solely on hate crimes perpetrated against the LGBTQ community. So what we have is Jamie Powell Horowitz, who is a very well-recognized, well-respected prosecutor. So she's actually been assigned as a special prosecutor sworn in by Kim in her office so that she can prosecute these cases in Wayne County. We have a special investigator named Vicki Yost, who has decades of law enforcement experience, and she serves as our investigator. And then we also have a victim's advocate, who is a trans woman by the name of Jaleesa Abad, and she works with the victims in our cases, and she's really been our liaison to the trans community to assist us with getting cooperation from transgender victims and also trans witnesses.
And so, Jamie, here you are, the former assistant prosecutor in Wayne County, and now you're sworn in and you're devoted to this. So what are you able to do now through working with this project, with the Fair Michigan Justice Project, that maybe you couldn't before?
Well, one of the most important things about this project is that we are able to vertically prosecute the cases, which means that as soon as the crime happens, as soon as we are aware of it, we are able to have contact with the victim. We stay with them through the entire case. So they're only dealing with one prosecutor, one advocate. So they don't have a multitude of people calling them. They don't have to be re-victimized repeatedly by having to tell their story to somebody else every step of the way. So it's, I think, comforting for the victim to have one person to deal with. Jaleesa Abad is our trans advocate. I have to say she has been invaluable to us. A lot of our trans victims are so nervous about coming to court. Even for them to come through the front door and go through security, have to take their jewelry off, have to take off their belt, they feel that this is such a difficult place to come to have to tell their story. So to have somebody stand with them, hold their hand, stay with them throughout the process, is very comforting. They know that there are law enforcement people who are on their side and that are going to help them through the process.
And then what are we getting in terms of the law enforcement side of things, where perhaps before a case was maybe put up on the, you know, in the cold file and kind of forgotten about? How is this changing that narrative?
I think it's getting better. Slowly but surely. And one of the big issues for me has always been not only with the LGBTQ community, but also with criminal justice, period, is there are certain segments of the people that I represent, and I represent all of the people of the state of Michigan, that just don't feel that the criminal justice system is for them, with them, cares about them. They feel that they're abandoned, ignored, and frankly, they're very afraid to be engaged, and they don't want to report horrible victimization. So
why? Help us understand why that is.
Either by the way they've been treated in the past, the way that they perceive they can be treated, the way they have been, actually, people have been treated, people of color, women with the rape kits. That's a whole thing behind the rape kits, as they were totally ignored. And this project addresses that. And we had many things that Dana and I and Jamie talked about is where we're going to do the interviewing, how we're going to do it, how we're going to be involved. Chief Craig was one of the first people we talked to, and he was on board. I believe we're working with some other departments. So slowly but surely, I think people are coming around, and a lot of people aren't, but I think people are at least beginning to realize that everybody deserves justice. They may not agree with the way we're doing it. They may not agree with a lot of things. I really think that people are coming around to the idea that everybody in the county of Wayne, everywhere, deserves justice. And we're just trying to give them a measure of justice that makes them feel recompensed somehow, makes them feel that they do matter, that makes them feel that going forward their cases are going to matter. And it helps us in the end because we want people to come forward. We want people to report any abuse, any victimization, any crime that happens to them. And hopefully, if nothing else, that's what's happening here.
Yeah, you know, the very first case that we did last summer in July, right after this project was formed, I think it was a week after Dana and Kim had started talking about putting this project together, there was an individual who posted on social media. He posted himself assaulting an LGBTQ man with a weapon, and he was spewing homophobic slurs. He posted online. This victim really highlights why this project was so important. This victim did not tell anyone. He did not tell his family. He did not tell his friends. He did not go to law enforcement. It was posted online. It caught the attention of Danny Woods at the Detroit Police Department, who is the liaison for the LGBT community. And we worked with her. Jaleesa Abad started making contacts in the community with people that she knew. We ultimately located him, and he talked to us about it. He did not want to go to the police. He did not want to talk about it to anybody but us.
But you created that safe space.
So we didn't make him come in. We went to him, and we gave him a safe space, and he was able to successfully come forward. And this was such a sad case because this victim, after being victimized, was actually told to leave his own home and told that it was his fault that this happened to him because he was gay. So this really highlights why it's so difficult for victims to come forward. They don't have the support. They have no support system in place. Jaleesa Abad, our advocate, was able to get services for him. We stayed in touch with him throughout the case, and we were very pleased at the result we got. The defendant is now serving time in prison for the assault.
And this is a really dangerous person. I mean, he was not just dangerous to the LGBTQ community, but, you know, he made threats against the police. He is a person that Wayne County and the state of Michigan is a much safer place with him behind bars right now. And even though, the ironic thing is that even though he had captured this offense on videotape, we would not have been able to prosecute him without the testimony of the complaining witness.
Right.
And so having this tool, if you will, of the Fair Michigan Justice Project, you're getting what you need to be able to go forward.
There's no question about it. There's no question about that most of the cases on this list probably wouldn't have, maybe all of them wouldn't have been prosecuted but for this project. But the fact that people feel free to put online, to say, to brag about their abuse of other people, and we're seeing it all over. But especially in the last, I'd say, last couple of years, especially people seem emboldened to attack members of this community. And to me, it's outrageous and it's intolerable and we won't have it.
Well, let's talk about what kinds of convictions and what are some of the cases.
We've had anything from criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, and those rape cases, assault with intent to murder. We've had a few of those, shootings, stabbings, felonious assault cases. That's assault with a dangerous weapon. We even had an extortion case. We frequently see people who are targeted online. Many times, defendants or suspects will target individuals based on their sexual orientation, lure them in with the promise of a romantic encounter, and then they will rob them, assault them, steal from them. We even had one individual, one suspect that we charged and prosecuted, who actually came to meet our victim wearing latex gloves. And when the victim refused to get into the car, the defendant shot him twice in the back while making homophobic slurs.
I'm wondering, as we are aware of national and local stories over these past couple of years about these cases you're talking about, the crimes against transgender people in Detroit, how would you characterize what the transgender community is facing in Detroit and in Wayne County?
Well, you know, what I can say about that is all of the LGBTQ community faces obstacles. I think that the trans community really has it the worst. And something that I had suspected, but then my fears were confirmed through our work in this project, is that a lot of people who are victimized, who are trans, are victimized specifically because they are left in a place where they're much more vulnerable than the rest of the population. Because we don't have any protections for sexual orientation or gender identity in our Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act, or even in the Ethnic Intimidation Act, which is our state hate law act, it leaves them more vulnerable. So you'll see a lot of trans people who, because they cannot get jobs, because it's difficult for them to get safe housing, they're left in a place where oftentimes they're on the street. And people who are on the street are going to be targeted more for violent offenses. And so you cannot fail to see the connection between the lack of protection in our state laws and the crimes that are being committed against the community. And, you know, when Kim talks about all of these murders or very serious assaults against trans women of color in the city of Detroit, I don't think that Detroit is inherently less safe than other major cities, but a lot of those other cities are in states that have protections. So a lot of these trans folks are able to get employment because they cannot be discriminated against. And unfortunately, that's not the case here in the state of Michigan. So the other thing that these laws tend to do is, by not protecting these very marginalized classes of people, it really sends a message to these offenders and to these perpetrators of these crimes that maybe mm-hmm. these classes of the people aren't as deserving of legal protections as all other people. And it emboldens them to commit crimes against these people because the message is, the state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're gay. The state of Michigan doesn't care about you if you're trans.
What's really interesting, though, is that the state of Michigan does require reporting to the Michigan State Police. The Michigan State Police then publishes their statistics to federal authorities. But we are required to keep stats of hate crimes involving sexual orientation. We don't include gender identity, but we do include sexual orientation. So while the state of Michigan requires reporting of these crimes, there's no hate crime law to prosecute these hate crimes under. So it's very disjointed and it doesn't make any sense.
And the thing that has been of such great comfort to me is at least I can say, well, maybe the state of Michigan doesn't care about you, but Wayne County does.
Ken, what's being done, Kim, in Wayne County with you as the prosecutor and then with the whole team that Fair Michigan has put together, is that filtering out to the rest of the state? And are people paying attention who matter?
I'd like to say it is. There are some of my colleagues across the state, for example, that are very, very receptive and are, I think, are beginning to do things in their own counties. For example, Jamie wrote a transgender apology when it came to prosecutions and how they should be treated. We made it a policy in Wayne County, and then I shared that policy with my 82 other colleagues across the state. And I think there were about five or six now that are considering making it part of their policy as well, and some that already have not a similar policy, but at least that philosophy. So I'm hoping they'll take that extra step and make it their policy.
It's a transgender interaction policy, which directs law enforcement personnel in their interactions with the transgender community. In Wayne County, we will always respect your gender identity. We will use proper pronouns. We will argue with the defense when they refuse to use proper pronouns. We will not allow our victims to come into court and be disrespected.
And what's great is actually, you know, the judges, almost uniformly that I've seen, have agreed.
They're very receptive in Wayne County, yes.
And giving people the proper language to use is very important. You can't fight crime. You can't be good at your job if you are not respectful to your victims. We always tell the police officers that we talk to and train and the prosecutors, we understand that people have differences of opinion. However, you always have to be professional and respectful, and it helps you to solve crime. It helps you to close cases.
Which
it
is
helps
what you want to do.
It helps you to get justice for these individuals. So being respectful is extremely important.
I'm wondering, Prosecutor Worthy, does being part of this project take anything out of your budget?
No, not right now.
No, she's smiling.
No. As a matter of fact, that's thank you for bringing that. That's a very important point.
Well, I would say that I would really like to thank the Wayne County Commission and specifically Commissioner Gary Warnchak, as well as Warren Evans, the county executive of Wayne County, because I know they've been working really hard to try to do whatever they can to make certain that we have adequate funding for this project. So that's something that they're working on, and we're expecting to see some funding hopefully coming from the county. Up until this point, it's all been private funding. It's been a lot of speeches on my behalf.
It's like a campaign.
Right.
And that's what it is.
I would liken it to Kim's efforts to secure funding to test the Detroit rape kits. And so, you know, I've taken a page out of her book to the extent that sometimes the system you have in place simply isn't working for whatever reason. You have to be willing to try to take innovative measures that haven't been done before in order to solve the problem. At the end of the day, the goal is to try to solve these crimes, try to protect the community, and that's what projects like this aim to do and have been successful in doing.
What I tell people all the time, I'm supposed to represent the people of the state of Michigan. It doesn't say I represent just the straight people of the state of Michigan. I represent everybody. And everybody has a right to be heard and to be given justice. And those that need help getting there, we have to have projects like this. And so when you talk about Detroit that was bankrupt a few years ago, the county of Wayne that had no money and had problems a few years ago that's coming out of that. So you can't tell any. You certainly can't tell me that you can't do anything with no resources. It's persistence. It's having friends that are willing to step out there who have great ideas and who are willing to work hard and try to get things done in a less than conventional way.
And Dana,
and it can be done.
The fact that this is really one of perhaps the only program of its kind in the nation, you have to have activists, LGBTQ activists across the country who would want to hear what you're doing and maybe replicate it in their states.
That was one of our big goals. And I know that Kim said from the very beginning that not only did we hope this was successful for Wayne County, which it has been, but we hope that this idea will spread to areas around the country. But As a person who is an LGBTQ person in Michigan, in a state that hasn't always made me feel so welcome, quite honestly, I am so proud to both live and work in Wayne County.
I want to grow up in a world where this isn't even an issue, that, you know, every person that does in law enforcement, every prosecutor that does these cases, the advocates have less to do, although there'll always be more. But that's the kind of world I want my children to grow up. I'm not going to grow up in that kind of world. But I want my children to grow up in that kind of world.
And this is a big start to this.
This is a start. And it's an example to children everywhere, I think. And I have to say that I'm very, very proud of this project. I'm proud of my government as well. And I think there's a whole lot more that we can give and a whole lot more that we can do as we get even more and more resourced.
The Fair Michigan Justice Project celebrated its one-year anniversary this past July. To mark that anniversary, you've been listening to our conversation with Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy, attorney and Fair Michigan President Dana Nessel, and the special prosecutor for the Fair Michigan Justice Project, Jamie Powell Horowitz. We should note, we recorded the conversation back in June. Since then, attorney Dana Nessel has announced she is running for state attorney general. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Tyler Scott. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.